Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Masoud Hussain is a professor of neurology and cognitive neuroscience at the University of Oxford, and he's a professorial fellow at New College, Oxford. He's a practicing clinician with over 30 years of experience seeing people with neurological conditions. He is the author of the award-winning book, Our Brains, Ourselves. Welcome to the show, Masoud.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to have you on. Tell us a little bit about your personal lives, more about your work, and why you do what you do.
I work between London and Oxford. I was born originally in what was then called East Pakistan and is now Bangladesh. I've become very anglicized, as you can hear. And my interests are really about our brains, how our brains normally operate. But I've learned an awful lot from looking after, studying, researching patients with brain disorders. And what I've got to learn from those experiences is people with brain disorders can tell us a lot about how our brains operate and have a lot of to teach us about how we can improve how our brains operate.
So 30 years of 30 years. Doing this kind of work, and how do you decide, or how do you pick the topic for a book? Because I'm sure you could have written 100 books.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to engage readers. I wanted to get people interested in what I'm talking about. So the people in the book are chosen specifically to illustrate different aspects of brain function, motivation, memory, attention, perception, how we have a representation of our bodies, how we empathize with people, and so on. So there were different aspects of brain function. And they were also chosen because they have relatively selective deficits. So it's not something, when I saw them, that had affected many different aspects of brain function. But what I try to show in the book is how even slight dysfunction in one of these very fundamental aspects of cognitive processes can alter people's identities, their personal identities, but it can also alter how they come across to other people, how they fit in, how they belong to communities, so their social identity. So that's how they were chosen. And you're quite right, I could have chosen many others, but I didn't want to just catalogue these things. I had a more overarching aim in the book, which is to show how brains create selves. So that's why it's called Our Brains, Ourselves. How our brains create what we call the self, you know. And the self has been something that people have talked on about for many, many centuries. Modern neuroscientists would say the self is essentially an emergent property of brains. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about the constellation of different cognitive processes that make George George and Masoud Masoud, and everyone very individual. So although these are very fundamental processes, they've developed in different ways as we have developed, and that's what creates our identities. That's what makes someone more motivated than somebody else. That's what makes somebody's memory much better than somebody else's.
Are any two brains the same? Are there certain types of brain types?
I mean, there are core architectures that are similar across all our brains, but our experiences, the genetics that we're born with, you know, they color everything about how our brains process information, our attitudes, our personalities. So it's both nature and nurture on top of that core architecture that modifies how brains turn out as we get to adulthood. Because, you know, we know a lot about how brains develop, that our brains are still developing into early adulthood. A lot of evidence that it's still developing into our early 20s. So it's a very slow modification in humans as we grow to a mature brain.
So a slight dysfunction, you mentioned that these slight dysfunctions play into pretty dramatically what our identities are like. Can you give me an example?
Well, for example, a woman who's described in the book comes to me not because she thinks she has a problem with her memory, but because her husband thinks she's got a problem with her memory. She hasn't really noticed anything that's a difficulty for her. He's noticed many things, including the fact that, they've gone on holiday, they've had a great time together, they're just about to leave when she says, "Oh no, you can't come home with me. My husband would be upset if you came home with me." And he is shocked by this because, he is a husband. So after a while, he says, "No, I don't think he would be. Why don't you give him a call? I'm a really good friend of his. I'm sure he'll be happy if I come home with you and you're just giving me a lift." And she makes a phone call. And while she's doing that, he goes out and takes the phone call on his mobile phone and says, "No, it's fine. Bring him along." So she says, "Steve, you can come along." And then, but when she gets home, she says, "I don't know which one of you Steves is going to stay with me tonight. You better make your mind up." So from her point of view, there isn't a problem with her memory, but clearly there is a dysfunction here because she's having difficulty in discriminating between who is her husband and who isn't. And of course, that is a dysfunction. And it turns out that this is the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease in this particular woman. She goes on to make other kinds of mistakes in terms of having fragile memories of clients and appointments at work and all this kind of stuff. But what I really wanted to show is that, of course, she has a disease process which is causing this problem, but there's a continuum of differences in how people's memories work. Some people are very good, some people are not. And we can learn an awful lot from the lives of others, like people with brain disorders, in terms of telling us which parts of the brain are important for constructing our memories. Turns out memories are not like video recordings. You don't press play and it shows you everything you did. They're reconstructions of the past.
So it's not that we are pulling a DVD off the shelf. We're not going and retrieving some hard copy of a memory out of our brain from somewhere.
Exactly. I mean, if you and I watch something like a bank robbery, our memories of that incident would be very different. And that's been shown a lot with eyewitnesses, right? I mean, in one famous study, people watched a video of a bank robbery, and then there was a lineup of eight people that were shown, and they were asked to identify the person who was the bank robber. Everyone pointed their finger at somebody, yet none of the people in the lineup had been in the video. So, it's our memories are fragile. They are reconstructions. They're not replays.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNC 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Are there certain types of brain functions that you focus on? I guess maybe the first question would be, how many different brain functions are studied?
Oh, well, that's a huge number, depending on who you speak and how you fractionate things up. So we could talk about perception. And if we talk about perception, there's visual perception or auditory perception or touch, various types of proprioception, knowing where your joints are in space, for example. We could look at attention. But even then, if we look at attention, what you pay attention to, there are many different types of attention, not only visual, auditory, somatosensory, etc., but also whether you can divide your attention, or whether you can focus your attention, or whether you can sustain your attention over time. So these are many different types of attention. And you can go on. We can talk about language, concepts, mathematics, and then some people call executive function. So these are an umbrella term for many different types of function that are important, for example, in planning, organizing, and thinking ahead to what we're going to do, but also being able to shift from one type of thinking process to another. And they're also very important in decision making. And some people think that aspects of executive function are also really important in social interactions, you know, how I empathize with somebody else. Do I have a fellow feeling? Can I see it from another person's point of view? So you can see already, George, that we've talked about over 20 different types of function, and people would fractionate further and further. But Marvin Minsky, who was one of the pioneers of AI, put it this way: it's like a society of mind. We have all these different types of processes going on. Most of them are under the hood. Most of them we're not really paying attention to, right? 95% of this stuff is going on without us consciously being aware of it. But they all contribute to the society of mind, what makes us us.
Is there a proper way for my brain to work, or is that very relative to me?
I don't think there's a proper way for any, you know, I don't think there's a recipe here, but I think it's worth considering the fact that, you know, for example, one of our areas of research is motivation and how motivation can go wrong, not only in people with brain disorders, but in healthy individuals. Why may motivation be fluctuating from time to time? There isn't a recipe here to say this is what you need to do to be highly motivated. But most people wouldn't necessarily think that there is a brain module, a brain circuit devoted to motivation. You know, most of us would think some people are lazy, some people are really, really highly efficient and motivated at what they do. But it turns out that the neuroscience is beginning to show that there is a brain circuit that's important for motivation to act. And that brain circuit is incredibly long in terms of how long it's been there from evolution. The lamprey, which is this eel-like creature, it's a sort of apex predator in rivers, hasn't changed for 360 million years. And it's successful because it's got this motivation circuit that takes its urges, you know, in terms of, let's say, finding a prey. When it gets hungry, it will, those urges will channel through to the brain circuits that lead to action to find the goal. And it turns out that same system, which runs into the basal ganglia, deep nuclei in the brain, and then to the frontal lobe, is with us. We have the same circuitry that is important for channeling our motivations to act. You know, in a couple of hours' time, I'm going to get hungry. I'm going to get this urge to find some food. I'm not going to expire if I don't eat. But nevertheless, this thing is going to be gnawing away at me, saying, you need to go and find something to eat. Or I could get thirsty, right? And there may be other motivational cues in our lives that make us want to get to the goal. And how do we evaluate those things? Well, the primary motivators like hunger and thirst are very relatively straightforward. But there are other important motivation signals. I mean, am I willing to work for a particular rewarding outcome? It turns out that that's a really important decision-making focus for humans in terms of deciding whether something is worth the effort, whether it's physical effort or cognitive effort. And we make those decisions and we decide whether we're going to do that. So we took a bunch of Oxford students, and believe it or not, some are really very apathetic and some are highly motivated. And we took a range of these students and put them into the brain scanner to look at their brain activity when they were making a decision about whether a particular outcome was rewarding enough to put in a level of physical effort. And we could change the combinations of how rewarding the outcome was and how rewarding, how effortful, you know, the action had to be. And we found that those areas that I mentioned in the lamprey, the basal ganglia and the frontal cortex in humans, are active when people are making decisions. But remarkably, the level of activity varies according to how motivated people are. And to our surprise, we found that the people who were most apathetic, the ones who were least motivated, actually showed greater activation in these brain regions, which are involved in that process of decision making. Is the reward worth the effort? And so at first we found that perplexing, but I think the reason is that for these people, there's a higher brain energy cost. They're taking more time, they're putting in more brain energy effort to work out whether this decision is worth it. Now, they can do that for us in the scanner, but at home, maybe they're just thinking, oh, this is too difficult. I don't want to decide. I don't want to think about whether this is worth it or not. I just won't do it, right? So I think we're getting real insights into the fact that there is a neuroscience behind the variation in people's levels of motivation. And that's not just across people. And of course, you know, we vary in our level of motivation day to day, sometimes hour to hour. And part of it is about this thing. Is it worth the effort? Am I really bothered to do this? Because I don't think this is going to be sufficiently rewarding. So you can see how, you know, we're beginning to understand some very, very simple things that nevertheless are really fundamental to how we behave.
The lamprey's not deliberating. It just goes and tries to attach itself to the prey.
Yeah, but we've got layers of deliberation. And of course, that can play a role in procrastination, why people don't do something, because they just think, ah, is this worth it? I'm not sure. Let's think a little bit more. Maybe I just won't do it.
This makes my brain hurt. I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why a lot of people who are like that find it more useful to schedule in a routine for themselves rather than, you know, every hour think, is this worth it? Shall I do it? No. You know, if you put that routine in, it takes away the brain hurt. And of course, you know, I guess many parents have learned to do that for their kids, but also many people have learned, let's put a routine in. Let's put in a schedule for today.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
I love and spend a decent amount of time thinking about self-management and just being a good steward of my resources. And I'm fond of saying that the beaver is my spirit animal, because you could put a beaver in Times Square, it's going to acquire wood and make a dam, even though it doesn't make any sense. And it's along the lines of the lamprey conversation. So is the opportunity, or is an opportunity, to take an honest look at myself and say, well, why do I find myself really deliberating and then not doing anything? And so, so the mechanism that if I were to desire to do more things, to just schedule the thing in, so I'm removing any decision-making process, I'm just going to this thing, then I go to that thing.
Yeah. And I think that can work for some people, but I'm not saying that we shouldn't also have time to do some proper reflection about deciding what to do next. And, you know, that's, of course, very important in strategic decision making for the future. I mean, it may be all right for your moment to moment thing. You may have three different tasks to accomplish in a week, so you can apportion different times during the week, different days, different hours for this kind of thing. But if you're thinking strategically for something bigger in the future, of course, I think this kind of solution isn't necessarily the one which will be the right thing. But yeah, in many cases, it's helpful to have a schedule for stuff that you know you've got to get done in a short period of time.
What do you think about the idea that my thoughts are separate from who I am? I'm me, my thoughts are them. I can choose what to do with them.
Yeah, I mean,
you can say that it's dumb.
No, I don't think it's dumb at all, because I think that, of course, you know, we can think of conditions where that becomes an extreme, that you know, in people who develop a psychosis, they really believe that some of those thoughts are other people's thoughts, right? Mm. And that they are getting thoughts from other people. So I don't think it's dumb at all. And you know, there is a continuum between normal understanding of reality and a psychotic understanding of reality. I think it is simply a continuum. You know, some people would say perception is a controlled hallucination. Our perception of the world is a controlled hallucination because it's not like watching a TV screen, although you might think of it like that, that, you know, everything coming in through your eyes is just being viewed by someone sitting there watching this stuff. It isn't that simple because we have to interpret that two-dimensional play of light on our retina and interpret what that means in terms of shadows, three-dimensionality. And that's what happens as we develop from babies to infants. We get to understand the structure of the world and how the play of light on our eyes conforms or corresponds to different objects, structures in the world around us, right? So we are interpreting the visual input. And that's why some people call this a controlled hallucination. We're interpreting it on the basis of our knowledge. But some people, like one of the people I mentioned in the book, who develops visual hallucinations, in those sort of individuals, what's happening is the visual input, not because of the eyes, but of the way the vision is processed by the brain, is fragile. And the interpretation of that visual input is incorrect. Instead of seeing shadows, they may see figures, people, silhouettes, who might seem threatening. So going back to your original question, you know, the idea that thoughts can be different from yourself is not necessarily something that's so wild.
It is, I think it's fascinating. So when somebody picks up our brains, our ourselves, what are you hoping that they really get out of it?
Well, I hope they get an understanding of the brain. So the original motivation was, let's explain what we know about modern neuroscience in a way that people will find compelling, that the storytelling will be such that they find it gripping, and that they also get to understand something about what modern neuroscience tells us about how brains function. Remember that people like Oliver Sacks, who wrote these great books, wrote them 50 years ago, and we've learned an awful lot since then. But as I wrote the book, I realized that actually the book is far more. The patients in this book are telling us about how our brains operate, but they're also telling us about how our brains create our identities, our personal identities, our social identities, how they make us feel that we belong in the constellation of people around us, how we fit in, and how easy it is not to fit in. Because, as I said, if you get dysfunction in one of these modules, it changes your personal identity. It also changes how you come across to other people. It changes your social identity. And it can make you, if you like, unbelong. It can make you lose that connection with people around you. So this is a much bigger project for me. It's about getting neuroscience over to people who wouldn't necessarily read science books, but it's also giving us, I think, an insight into how brains create ourselves and make us belong to the people around us.
Do most people feel like they belong? Is that knowable? Is there a percentage breakdown?
Well, I think you'd know when you don't belong. Actually, that's probably to call yourself a self, you have to have some distinction from others. Otherwise, it makes very little sense. And I think one of the things we've learned from many years of research is that intrinsically, people have a sense of who they are, not only as a person, but who they are in relationship to other people. So, you know, if I ask you, George, tell me about yourself, who are you? You might tell me about where you were born, where you grew up, your parents, the people around you, you know, what sort of jobs you did. But you would also talk about the kind of teams that you support, the kinds of maybe your religion, maybe the language you speak. If you weren't a native English speaker, for example, the culture you came from, right? All of that is so important in who we think ourselves to be. When you asked me, I said I was originally born in what was East Pakistan in Bangladesh, but I've lived in the UK for many years. That's why I've become very anglicized. I'm telling you about my roots, and my roots are about my connections with other people.
I've heard that being lonely is like smoking cigarettes. It's really bad for you. And one of the top regrets of those who are dying is that and the wish I'd kept in touch with my friends. So do most people feel a sense of belonging? I don't know if that's different than the question I asked you, but it's healthier to have a sense of belonging, or?
It certainly is healthier, because you're quite right. The evidence suggests people who become socially isolated not only are more likely to become depressed, which is understandable, remarkably, they are more likely to get dementia and also die earlier. And exactly how these changes in the brain lead to this situation is not understood. But presumably there's a degree of stress, a latent stress in being socially isolated, that has an impact on our heart and the vascular system as well. So loneliness is actually something that has a remarkably significant impact on people's lives, especially if you're becoming lonely as you grow older, because as you become older, maybe your roles change, your job may have stopped being what it was, the children grow up, your friends may have moved away, you're more likely to have a smaller social circle. And that is a really important factor in terms of determining your risks for dementia, almost as important as all the other things people tell us. Make sure you exercise, make sure you don't drink too much alcohol, make sure your blood pressure is under control, that you're not diabetic, all this, you don't smoke. Being lonely is as important as any of those factors.
Fascinating. Somebody should study that connection.
Yeah, no, exactly. But it's quite difficult to study, right? You can do the population health stuff, but actually trying to work at the mechanism would require an awful lot of work. I mean, for example, you probably would need blood samples and to measure the sort of levels of adrenaline and noradrenaline as one measure of stress, or corticosteroids, as another measure of stress. Other measures of inflammation in the body, that's the kind of thing you need to do, but it needs a big study to do that.
All right. One of these days. Well, Masoud, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people learn more about you? How can they engage with you? Where can they get their copy of Our Brains, Ourselves?
Okay. Well, we have a website, masoudhussain.org. If they want to get a copy, they can buy a copy online from any good bookseller.
Excellent. Well, if you enjoyed this much as I did, show Masoud your appreciation. Share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Go to masoudhussain.org. That's masoudhussain.org. And pick up your copy of Our Brains, Ourselves, wherever you buy fine books. Thanks again, Masoud.
Thank you, George.
Until next time, remember, do your part by doing your best.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.